Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on episode 97, the 660s BC, part 2 of 4.
We are in 668, and we are reading from the Babylonian Chronicle again. The accession year of Sama-Shuma-Ukin, that is the brother of Ashurbanipal, and the year is given is 668, 667 then, because of the split of the Babylonian year compared to us. In the month Ayaru, April, May, you harvest sowing sesame. Bel and the gods of Akkad went out from Ashur, and on the 25th day of the month Ayaru, they entered Babylon. Nabu and the gods of Borsippa went to Babylon. And Borsippa is a Babylonian city. We talked about it before. It's the city of truth and justice. And Nabu is the son of Marduk. He goes to Babylon every year to see his father for the Akitu festival. More on this in a few minutes. And what actually happens here then is Sama-Shuma-Ukin, that's a great name, is installed as the king of Babylon, as a subordinate king to Ashurbanipal. Mm-hmm. This is probably not going to lead to good things.
No, and even here, it took a year. This is like, it took a year until he was installed as king of Babylon. Because remember, the last year was when we read that Ashurbanipal became the king of Assyria.
Yeah, that's probably Ashurbanipal asserting himself as the number one guy in Assyria first, before he leaves Babylon to be governed by his brother.
Right.
But this is a great way to avoid doing the duties of the Babylonian king himself. So I can see the use of this move, but it's dangerous. Yeah,
definitely. These guys have egos, you know, and then it's not good to...
Yeah, spoiler, the Assyrians will never really figure out how to handle Babylon. It has been a constant problem since we began this podcast. And yes, it's just, they never find a good way to rule Babylon.
No. And we have a lot, and there's a lot of stuff going on in the 50s.
Oh, we'll get to that. Do you want to do the next part?
In that same year, Kirbitium was taken and its king captured. And this was a region to the east of Babylonia and was apparently harassing Babylon. I'm not really sure if this king had any brains because, like, raiding Babylonia so the Assyrians will come and kill you. But that's what happened to him.
That seems like a very short-sighted tactic.
Seriously. I mean, yeah. They just, you know, what was this about? You look at, they were making raids into Babylonia.
Or maybe it was just the Assyrians saying that, oh, this guy's harassing us.
Yeah, it could be. It's possible.
But he will say, well, I'm not harassing you. Oh, you are harassing us.
Maybe they're all just trying, you know, maybe they're trying to make them use all their arrows up. All these wars. I mean, just think how many arrows they must go through. So... Anyway, seriously, though, I mean, you definitely can't just keep going to war if you got to make a million arrows every time you go out.
And remember that the Assyrians are merchants and capitalists, so somebody's getting rich in Assyria making tons of arrows.
Right, you're right. That's the industrial military complex of Assyria, was the arrow factories.
The arrow barons.
Yeah, for sure. So let's see. On the 20th day of the month, Tebetu, which is December, January, and sowing of onions, Bel-Attir, the judge of Babylon, was taken prisoner and executed. So I couldn't find out what he did, actually, but I don't think anybody really knows. But there's some other tablets with that same name and business transactions from the same time. And also in the 650s, though, so it clearly can't be the same guy. And then Bel is the Akkadian word for Lord. So there's a lot of people named Bel. So Bel-Attir, there could be a lot of Bel-Attir, but that's like Lord Attir.
Maybe Bel-Attir is the Lord Yad.
Yeah, exactly. So there's, you know, they're always conspiring against the Assyrians in Babylon. So,
of course,
that's the deal there. And then there's another chronicle that's about the same. And it says, it's called the Akitu Chronicle. And it says, for 8 years under Sennacherib, for 12 years under Esarhaddon, 20 years altogether, Bel stayed in Baltil, which is the word for Asher. And the Akitu festival did not take place. The accession year of Sama-Shuma-Ukin, in the month of Ajuru, Bel and the gods of Akkad went out from Baltil, and on the 24th day of the month, Ajuru, they entered Babylon. Nabu and the gods of Borsippa went to Babylon. Well, first of all, unfortunately, this is the last we have of this chronicle until 652 BC, which just stinks because there was, you know, it was good to get that information. But you can see the Babylonians were really big on that, the fact that they didn't have this festival for 20 years. And it was because of the Assyrians. Since Sennacherib sacked Babylon, took all the statues, they haven't been able to have this festival. So they're really mad about it. Now, they
finally this is a great populist move by Shamash-shum-ukin. He's returning the statues.
Right. Shamash-shum-ukin and Ashurbanipal, they're returning the statues. And then they're able to have this festival, which is the Babylonian New Year's Eve festival. Not New Year's Eve, I'm sorry. It's the New Year's festival, and celebrates their supreme god Marduk and his crown prince and the other gods.
And it's the actual statue of Marduk himself that is returning to Babylon.
Correct.
And that's pretty important.
Super important.
It's the main god of Babylon, and this would give them ideas of independence again.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they already had those ideas.
But I mean, you know, the Assyrians, they did a rule over that festival before they sacked Babylon. It's just a huge festival. I'm gonna talk about it a little bit. It's such a huge thing. Is what they do is they, it starts on the first of the year. And that's, you know, that's in March and April. So that's the first of the, because of the harvest time, you know, it's an agricultural schedule. It was celebrated in two locations, at the supreme temple of the god Marduk and the house of the new year, which was situated north of the city. And the two gods in the center of the festival were Nabu and his father, Marduk, who's the supreme god. And he was called Bel, Lord, just like we call, you know, the Lord, that kind of thing. And the high priest, yep, of the temple opened the festival, saying the new year has begun. To the populace, this meant the beginning of a whole week of holiday. And the same day, the king went to the temple, where the high priest gave him the royal scepter. Then he traveled to Borsippa, which is 17 kilometers downstream, and they had a famous Nabu temple. And there the king spent the night. And the same year, the high priest recited the Babylonian creation epic in the house of the new year. So then on the fifth day, the king returned to Babylon, accompanied by the statue of Nabu. And the statue was left behind at the Uruk gate. And the king went to the temple to greet Marduk. And here's the cool. He had to do this humbly, laying down his weapons, his crown, and his scepter. And the high priest listened to the king's words that he had not sinned against Marduk. And then he hit him very hard on the cheek. The priest hit the king very hard on the cheek. And the king had to have tears in his eyes. And supposedly this is punishment for sins that were unwillingly committed. Kneeling in front of the statue of Marduk, the king receives an oracle about the future, and he was given back his royal insignia. At sunset, the king and the high priest performed a not completely understood ritual with a white bull. I won't get into any more of that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The next day, the statue of Nabu visited the temple of Ninurta, where it defeated two enemies in the form of some little golden statuettes. It then continued to the temple, where it joined Marduk's statue. And then at the same time, all the other gods arrived in Babylon. So now this party's been going on for, this is on the seventh day, 7 days. All the statues are cleaned and they get new dresses. And the next day, the festival reached its climax when all the statues were brought out from their rooms and shown to the Babylonian populace. And all the gods were present to honor Marduk in their parliament. So it's like his conference, his congress there. They announced the policy for the next year. It's like the State of the Union speech by the American president. As far as we know, it was always a blessing, fortune, joyful tidings, these kind of things. And they went around the city with the statues. The king guided the supreme god. And the last part of the route, the ships were placed on chariots so that the gods were driven to the house of the new year in ships. And this is the part, it's cool too. The people were just singing all kinds of songs. There was like frivolous hymns of sexuality and a song about Marduk's father and just I mean, it was just a huge party for, you know, 7 days in Babylon. They couldn't have it for 20 years because of the statues weren't there. So that must have been a really cool party.
I have two reflections. First, did Shammah Shumukin really take a beating from the high priest? But he probably did then if he wanted to do this properly. Yeah. And the second reflection is there seems to be a lot of carrying of statues in this festival and a lot of rather boring things. But it is a lot of time to have a festival for a week. So maybe the rest of it was just drinking and partying and having a good time.
I bet it was that. I bet you the priest did their thing, but the rest of it was drinking and partying and having a good time. We do have something sort of like that in our area here. It's an old so we have a lot of Italian immigrants here. I'm half Italian. We have a city here that they have a festival where the saints do a race and the people carry the statues of the saints in a race. And it's all drinking and partying.
What happens if you drop the saints?
They never do. They never do. You have to pick, you know, strong young guys that get to run with the saints.
Interesting. Okay. What time
of
year is that?
It's summer. The St. Ubaldo Festival, it's called.
Wow.
Yeah. And they carry the saints in a race. And, you know, the St. Ubaldo always wins. It's that sort of a deal. And people line up along the track. And, you know, the older people are more religious about it. And the younger people are drinking.
So we'll put the Akito Festival in our top 10 list of events to attend if we ever get a time machine.
Yes, it'll be Dan and Bernie's excellent adventure.
I think we would stick out in Babylonia.
We have to dress.
Yeah, we have to dress the part.
You'll probably get by because you pronounce the words so well. I'll be the one immediately. They'll catch on me.
They would burn us both.
We'll get right back in the time machine.
So please support us on Patreon so we can start building the time machine.
Yes, that would be awesome.
We probably need a quintillion dollars, so make a substantial contribution, please.
We'll start with $1 a month, $1 an episode. That's all we ask.
Yes, from 68 million people, or quintillion people. Yeah,
exactly.
Time for some Greece.
Yeah, 668 still. It was an Olympic year, and there was some drama, but I have the victors, well, what we know anyway, and boxing was not me. It was a Dipos of Croton, and Croton was a Greek colony in Calabria in Italy. It's on the bottom of the boot. And their inhabitants are famous for physical strength. And I just want to throw this in because this is the hometown of Milo of Croton, who would later become a legendary wrestler of tremendous strength. And I have this friend, he's our boxing swimming coach. And he always tells a story about how Milo's put Ken, by the way, shout out to Ken. So the story goes that he started with a calf, put it on his shoulders, like a calf of a bull. And he put it on his shoulders and he'd walk around with it. And as the cow got bigger and bigger and bigger, he got stronger because, you know, the cow got bigger, like lifting weights. So he's from the 500s BC, so he's a long way off.
I can see some holes in this story. Like, didn't the calf get malnutrition suffer from the lack of movement?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just, you know, if we put it down every so often. You know how these stories are, they embellish.
Yes. This could be the reason why the Assyrians have great calves.
Calves, that's, yeah, could be why.
Okay, maybe there's a difference between calves
and calves.
I know,
they
calves.
Calf raises with a calf.
Sorry, go on.
The stadium was won by Charmus of Sparta. I don't have any info on this guy.
But it's another Spartan winning the Olympics. Go Sparta! Yeah.
And then the pentathlon was won by Philombrotos of Sparta. And I don't have any information on this guy, but I don't think we talked about the pentathlon before.
Well, we can do it again if we did.
Yeah, so it derives from the combining the words penta and athlon, which means five competition. Five events over one day. It started with the stadium and then followed by the javelin throw, the discus throw, and the long jump. We're not sure which order those were in. And then ended in wrestling, which is crazy, right? You have like a race and some throwing and then wrestling. You know, it's like single events and then you fight somebody. But that's funny because they said the pentathletes were considered to be inferior to the specialized athletes in a certain event. But that means they were superior overall in development because they're the most well-balanced of all the athletes. And their training was part of military service.
Each of the five events was thought to be useful in battle, though I don't know how useful long jump is in battle.
Yeah, maybe jump over like, maybe like when, you know, jump over a moat for the castle. Not the castle, but, you know, the city.
I don't know much about sports today, but decathlon is the 10 things. And those athletes are also inferior than specialized athletes, but very good overall.
Yeah, right. And I'm pretty sure there's not wrestling in the decathlon.
I do believe you correct. Oh, Argos news.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the drama. This is probably the year that Phaidon, who was the tyrant of Argos, was asked by the town of Pisa to capture the sanctuary of Zeus, where the Olympics were held. And so he did, and he personally presided over the games. So that was some drama.
And then Elis took back the sanctuary.
Yeah, the next year, but he ruined those Olympics.
Yeah, so seems like a PR move for him.
Yeah, I mean, he physically took over the Olympics.
Well, while the Spartans were busy fighting the Second Messenian War.
Apparently.
What more can you tell me about Phaidon?
Phaidon's an interesting character, actually. Some say he was a noble. Some say he's a king. And either way, he overthrew who was in charge, and he was an usurper, and he became more a tyrant. And sort of like Gyges, who was a tyrant, which means he seized control. He wasn't the rightful king. Likely overthrew the aristocracy with the help of the lower classes. But this kicks off the age of the tyrants in the Greek world, because then there was other tyrants around the Greek world. So this is the age of the tyrants. These guys did a lot of big building projects to, please the masses. That's why they had that support of the lower classes. But then they needed money. They need a way to pay these guys. So this could sort of be when why money became needed. We also see that they may need some kind of money to pay their mercenaries at the time. But it's been said that Phaidon was the first to coin money. But Herodotus says, and it's pretty much believed it was the Lydians. And the earliest coins found in Argos are from the 500s. And we did say that, the Lydians are the ones who started money. But Phaidon had something to do with standardizing weights. So that may be why they think he started money. He would give you a pound of silver or, this much gold for doing this or that. So, but the really cool thing is that he is probably the inventor of the hoplite as we know it and a proto phalanx. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. It happened right here in the 660s BC on our podcast.
That's a major invention.
Yeah, right? And I didn't just.
We know that the phalanxes had existed before in other countries, but not in Greece.
Yes, correct. Right, so the Greek style of the phalanx and the Greek hoplite, we think, and this is pretty, we're pretty sure, this is the era when it started, because even the Spartans didn't use a phalanx at this time, that's why they were fighting, the Messenians were still battling with them. And the main thing is the shield, the apsis, because they call the grip on it the Argive grip, because that placed the handle in the center of the shield and it had a leather strap to fasten your forearm. I don't know if it fit the Assyrians, but so can't stop, right? Could you imagine though? You have the shield. It's like you're fumbling with your shield, and brilliant! Let's just strap it on. So now you have the shield. You could hit people with the shield, and you could hold your spear under your arm. You're not fumbling with your shield. So, and that's that one little thing is the start of the phalanx, and so then this made him powerful. So he took the show on the road. And he defeated a Spartan invasion at the Battle of Hassai in 668, which is right around the time of the Second Messenian War. There's not a lot of sources, and I did read a lot. I found, it was just like little blurbs, but there was, apparently a battle there, and Argos was victorious.
A lot of Greek sources mention that the Spartans were never defeated, and in that podcast I mentioned before, the Ancient History Warfare podcast, that's their most common in-joke that, but the Spartans were never defeated, and then they are defeated all the time.
Right.
So, but they were pretty quick to adapt this, and they became quite proficient in phalanx warfare.
Mm-hmm. And strong, and, and like we said, veterans, and used to it, and willing to die.
Yeah, and extremely well-trained in physical endurance.
Yeah.
Not only calves and forearms.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. This Plutarch has a good little story about Phaidon. Can I read that? Yeah.
Go ahead.
A man named Phaidon, who was striving to make himself ruler of the Peloponnesians and wished his own native city of Argos to be the leader of all the other states, plotted first against the Corinthians. He sent and asked of them the 1,000 young men who were the best in vigor and valor. And they sent 1,000, putting a man named Dexander in command of them. Now, Phidon intended to make an onslaught upon these men, and he was going to kill them, so that Corinth might be weakened and he might have the city in his power. For he considered that it would be the most advantageous bulwark of the whole Peloponnesus. And he confided this matter to some of his friends, among whom was Hebron. Now, he was a friend of Dexander, this Hebron was, and told him of the plot. So before the onslaught was made, the 1,000 young men escaped back safely to Corinth. The trickster.
This story just makes me convinced that everybody was stupid. Like, the whole trick seems stupid. Like, please send 1,000 strong young men. Then you think that Corinthians would go, why? But Phidon obviously had a good reason for that. And then, I'm going to kill them all. I have to talk to my friends about my cunning plan. And then Hebron goes like, well, he's going to kill you all, so you better not come here. And they just, okay, we'll go back to Corinth.
Gosh, right?
Corinth is situated in an extremely strategic position for control of the Peloponnese. So that Phidon was correct in that. Mm-hmm.
That is a great little stories. I think they just drank a lot.
You know, probably.
They're just drinking. And then they said, I'm going to kill all those guys. So, yeah, around this time, well, so then he died. We don't know exactly when, but they said he died in a battle, a factional battle in Corinth after their king was overthrown. So, like, these guys were talking other people into overthrowing their kings. It's definitely like a revolution of tyrants. And around this time, also, the Second Mycenaean War ends. It's really hard to date it. So we'll just put it here in 668.
And it does end with Sparta winning, right?
Yes, it ends with Sparta winning.
Good work, Sparta. Yeah.
And then they made the slaves out of them.
Oh, no.
So that was it, though, for the Spartans as far as colonizing, as we said before. That was, you know, they had their own, basically, they had their hands full with their helots there, with the Mycenaeans. And they had a lot of land, too, so they really didn't need to go, you know, island hopping like the other ones.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, I missed this one little part when we talked about the war originally. So what happened was, the part I missed, and I guess it's good for now, we could use it now since it's over. The Spartans went to the Oracle of Delphi asking for help, what they should do about the war because it was going on so long. Oracle told them to go get a poet from Athens, get somebody from Athens. And the Athenians didn't want to give them anybody, so they gave them this lame old stupid schoolmaster guy that they thought was, you know, going to be just a fool. And it turns out he was their savior because he wrote all these poems and hymns and songs that, you know, motivated the Spartans, and then they came back and then they won. That's how the story was.
Inspirational poetry.
Yeah, from the lame poet from Athens.
Good work, lame poet of Athens. Was he both lame and blind?
He wasn't blind, because I double, triple checked it recently. They just said he was stupid.
Huh. And lame.
Lame and stupid. I mean, anyone knows lame has anything to do with being stupid, obviously. So, just, you know. Obviously, he wasn't that stupid, because he helped them.
Maybe he was bullied in Athens, and now
probably.
He found his true
spot. I think that's probably it.
Let's proceed to 667.
Yeah. 667, the Greek state of Megara founds the colony of Byzantium, which would become Constantinople, is today Istanbul.
The site of the Byzantine Empire.
Yes, so a long ancient
city. Much later.
Mm-hmm. But this is where it gets its founding. In the Byzantine Empire, and it's called Byzantium in 667 BC, so it had a lot of, the name carried itself a long way.
It's such a perfect spot for a city. That's a strategic location, right at the very border of Egypt and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And you control the entry to the Black Sea, and it's just a great spot.
Absolutely. I mean, remember that they had the, you remember how it went, right? The other colony that was nearby, the colony of the blind.
No.
Remember Chalcedon?
Remind me.
They founded that in the 680s, and they called it the City of the Blind. Here's the story. A legend has the founder was this guy named Byzus, and his father went to the oracle and said we needed to found a new colony, and she told him to set up his new colony in the land opposite the City of the Blind. Remember? So when he got there, he realized that there was a colony on the other side, and they said, they must have been blind to set up here. This is a great spot. So,
really good question. Why they didn't set up on the good spot
before? Right, because they might have been blind, as they say. I mean, wonder why didn't anybody else set up there before? So
Somebody must have in all those years before, but maybe it was a dangerous place to be if you couldn't fortify it, and because everybody was passing through right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, so the guy's name was Byzas, and that's why it's Byzantium.
Yeah, and makes sense.
But then it became Constantinople. You know why Constantinople got the works? Nobody's business but the Turks. You know the song? You know the song? The song?
No, I don't
oh,
know,
don't
the,
know
song.
The song. Oh, it's well, a lot of people would know the "They Might Be Giants" song. It's Istanbul was Constantinople.
It's, okay.
So, it's Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. People will know it. So it's a "They Might Be Giants" song, but it's actually a remake of a song by this another band. Called the Four Lads. There's a little extra history. I'll throw this in here. So Istanbul, not Constantinople. It's a 1953 novelty song with lyrics by Jimmy Kennedy and music by Nat Simon, performed by the Four Lads. It was written on the 500th anniversary of the fall of Constantinople to the Ottomans. And the lyrics humorously referred to the official 1930 renaming of the city of Constantinople to Istanbul.
Ah, did not know that.
See. Maybe it's an American thing.
My father actually used to sing that song.
Oh, he did?
I remember now, but I never know where he got it from. So now I know. You have resolved this lifelong mystery
for me.
There you
go. My kids are probably saying the same thing because I sing it all the time. I actually went to Istanbul in the 90s, and I couldn't get it was in my head the whole time.
Oh, I've never been there. I had the option of going. I was in Bulgaria, and it was like a two-day trip to Istanbul with the... But we decided to stay at a hotel and just drink and do other things there.
Well, if I'm... Yeah.
Instead.
Well, I went the opposite. I know, you're absolutely right, because I went the opposite way. I took the two-day trip from Istanbul to Bulgaria.
Oh.
Yeah, brutal, brutal trip.
In what sense?
Like, just bus, train, border... Like, people on the bus smoking the whole time. You know, 8 hours in a bus of people smoking, and it took forever, like you said.
I was going to go with a charter company, so my bus would have been very comfortable. But I was on my honeymoon, and I hadn't started Final History at the time. This was back in 2012.
Uh-huh. Well, this was back in me. This was in the 90s, and I didn't have any money. I was backpacking. But yeah, where were we in Bulgaria? I was in Sofia.
I was in, God, I can't remember, that normal tourist spot for Scandinavian tourists in Bulgaria.
Oh, there were Scandinavians on the bus with us, I remember, at the end, and we went to see the bear together.
Golden Beach or something?
Oh, there was, though. I remember. Anyway, I digress. Maybe someday we'll all get back, right?
Yes. With the Final History tour.
Yeah.
When we get this going.
Yeah, we'll get that going. Just don't forget, a buck an episode. We'll save the money. That and the time machine.
Yes. Oh, first a trip to Bulgaria, then the time machine. I think that's the right way to
Absolutely.
They had an awesome place where you could eat like the Bulgars. So you had a gigantic tent and you were eating like barbecued meat like the Bulgars did when they invaded Bulgaria. Okay, we have now gotten
far
off track.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, fans.
Back to Megara.
Yes. Yeah, so like I said, Chalcedon, the city of the blind, it was also a Megaran colony, so... I did my little distance thing. The distance from Megara to Byzantium is about 1,100 kilometers or 885 miles. It would take you 12 hours by car on the E90 today. Or if you flew, it would be an hour and 20 minutes. And I did take that route on a train. I took the train to Istanbul and then back to Bulgaria. I think that's how it went. But anyway, I remember looking out the window. It was beautiful. Very beautiful. So, but they would have took it by ship, and it would have taken them, I think, at least 30 days to get there. So it's not like super far, you know, it's not like going, you know, across the giant ocean. But like I said, that would Byzantium, then Constantinople, then Istanbul had a long history. It was the imperial capital. So how about this? It was an imperial capital under the Romans and then the Ottomans from 330 CE till 1922. So that's been a capital, like a capital of a major empire since 330 CE till 1922. And today it's the most populous city in Turkey and one of the most populous in the world with 14 million population.
Also the biggest city in Europe.
Yeah.
If you count it as
Europe. Yeah, because you go bull, you can walk across the bridge and go over the other side.
Well, if you ask people from London or Paris, they will say that only the European side of Constantinople counts. So we are bigger.
Yes.
Actually, Constantinople plays a part in my novel about Alaric and the fall of Rome in 410 CE. But that's another story.
Are you still writing it?
No, I'm not. Right. And I haven't finished it. But there is a lot of scenes set in Constantinople under Emperor Arcadius in from 395 to 410. So I know way too much about Roman politics in the period 395 to 410 CE.
There's more information than you think, right? When you really start digging into this stuff.
Yes, and that's why I stopped writing the book, because it started to become a fact book.
Yeah.
And I found the balance very hard.
Yeah.
So now I write mainly fantasy. Ah,
all right. Well, I'm still impressed that you, the other writing you do.
Yeah. Thank you.
I know that's difficult.
If you can read Swedish, you can read my books.
I can't even do that either.
So if you have Swedish listeners, ask me and I'll tell you about my books. We are going back to Assyria.
Yes,
it's the rest of the Esarhaddon Chronicle. It's mostly broken up.
Unfortunately.
So this will be very unsatisfying to read, but I'll try anyway. The first year of Shamash-shuma-ukin, that is 667-66, something, two, something. Taharqa, king of Egypt, something. Egypt, something. Necho, king of Egypt, something. And that's all we have for 667 in the Chronicle. But you have something else.
Yeah, well, I have... Because of, like I was saying, you can find all this stuff on the internet. I have all the inscriptions from Ashurbanipal, because as we know, he was a scholar and he had tons of stuff. So he has all of his things. So the only difference is between his stuff and the Babylonian Chronicle is he doesn't date it the way they do. You know, they say the first year to second year. He'll say, like, on my second campaign, on my third. So we can't, like, get the dates exactly, you know, down to the year, but we can get the time. So my point is, we're not losing all the information. You know, we just don't have those, you know, year-to-year things, which for me, doing this podcast with you is make the research is great, because we could just put it, this is what happened in this year for sure. So,
yeah, it's been a problem with all the Assyrian kings. I will probably go on about Ashurbanipal's library a lot in this podcast. I'll not mention it now.
Okay.
Proceed.
Oh, right. So, yeah. So, what's going on here? Well, we know back in 669, remember, Esarhaddon died on his way to Egypt. So, while Ashurbanipal was occupied at home, you know, with the changing over the everything, Taharqa took advantage of the situation and he attacked the Assyrian garrison at Memphis and he occupied the city. So, then Ashurbanipal sent an Assyrian force to Egypt. He didn't go with his armies. Ever. He was not like the other kings. He let his generals do the work. So he sent the Tertanu, which is an Akkadian word for commander-in-chief or like a prime minister, and the chief eunuch went to the army. So what they also seems they did is they went through the Levant and they picked up a bunch of troops there. So that's another thing real quick is like, you look at a map of the Assyrian Empire in the old days, and a lot of times you'll see like Judah as being like not part of it, but that's not really true because they were a client state and there was 22 other client states in the area. So, you know, technically they weren't an Assyrian province, but they didn't really have, you know, they were client states of Assyria. So anyway, they went through, picked up all these other, you know, soldiers, probably had their own arrows and everything else. You know, you can imagine how much stuff they would need. And they arrived in Egypt. And this army fought a pitched battle with Cushites in the vicinity of Kar-Benite. And this is probably near Memphis. And I'm telling you, you could spend hours trying to dig into people saying where it is. So it's near Memphis, I'm pretty sure. And the Assyrians won, and Taharqa fled from Memphis, and he went down to Thebes. And that is a distance of 481 miles or 774 kilometers. That I know. I could check that. So 481 miles away, Taharqa goes down to Thebes.
And Thebes is also the traditional stronghold of the Nubian kings in Egypt. So that's the last line.
The last line of defense against the evil Assyrians.
Unless they come to Nubia, of course.
Right, but that's really getting
that's
far.
Not very likely.
That's really running down there. So then, yeah, the chief eunuch, not the Tanto, right? Just the chief eunuch, he went south by foot and ship to follow. And this voyage lasted 10 months. So that suggests there was, like, you know, resistance along the way. And, you know, some kind of gorillas, not the animals, the gorillas, humans. So Taharqa went to Thebes, right? And the Assyrians 10 months later go down there to get him. And maybe because they were worn out, it appears that Taharqa beat the Assyrians here.
Or maybe the chief eunuch was just taking his time, enjoying the pleasures.
Maybe it did. Maybe. I don't know how many pleasures a eunuch could have, though.
We'll talk about gorillas very soon, actually, in this podcast.
You're right.
Because we will address the question, did the Phoenicians circumvent Africa? And that story involves gorillas.
Yes, it does. I know it, too.
But it's probably for the next
while.
The next
and
century,
see, that's right? Why you are, like I said, you have all that knowledge in your head about, you know, history like those guys. I would have forgot that if I ever knew it. But I do know it now from this. And that has to do with this podcast, because this is the dynasty that does that gorilla trip. Right. And I believe he was Necho II. Right. Okay. So anyway, but it appears that Taharqa wins again. So Taharqa beats the Assyrians every so often.
Way to go, Taharqa.
Right. So he beats them here. And then those three guys up north, they say, oh, crap, the Assyrians got beat, right?
All of them. All three.
Yeah. The three guys we mentioned before that Esarhaddon had installed up there, and one of them was Necho. These guys decided to revolt against the Assyrians. But don't forget the other.
But they don't have Nubian support up there.
I know. Well, that's what I mean. He figured that they'll beat them. He figured they must have figured the Assyrians went down and that Taharqa beat the Assyrians.
Yeah, but you probably need the Nubians to beat the Assyrians.
Probably do need them to, you know. But, you know, I just think there's not information like we had today, like we have today. Because even today, people say fake news. Yeah, that's fake news. Yeah, so somebody comes and says, you know, the Assyrians are pretty tough. They're probably not that tough. Fake news.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, not a good idea. But then don't forget that only the chief eunuch went south. The prime minister, the Turtanto, you know, I'm the worst. So he was still there, and the conspiracy was discovered. So, yeah,
uh-oh.
Right? So the cities where these guys were in charge of were slaughtered.
All of them?
Yeah, they slaughtered the cities. But what happens is one of these guys escaped somehow. The other two, they captured. The Assyrians took them to Nineveh.
Oh,
what do you
no.
think happened to them? You should go down.
They were never heard from again.
Right? Well, not yes and no. Because
okay.
for some reason, Necho was pardoned and reinstated as the ruler of Sais. And they threw in Memphis, too.
Yeah. What?
They keep you guessing, those Assyrians.
Or maybe Necho was just the king of sweet talk.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It reminds me, I don't know, there's this Netflix series, Ozark, and this guy goes against the cartel, Mexican cartel, and every episode they're about to kill him. And he goes, I'll fix this. He always, like, sweet talks his way out of it.
That's Necho, though.
Yeah, that's Necho. Against the Assyrian troops, my royal host, which I had stationed in Egypt at their request, they planned evil. My officials heard these matters, seized their couriers, together with their messages, and saw with their own eyes their rebellious plot. They seized these kings and bound them hand and foot with bonds and fetters of iron. The curse of Asher, king of gods, overtook them, because they sinned against the oath they had sworn by the great gods. I required at their hands the good which I had done them in kindness, and the people of Sais, Pentiti, and Sinu, and the rest of the cities, as many had joined with them in plotting evil, they struck down with the sword. Both great and small, not a man of them escaped. Their corpses they hung on stakes. They stripped them of their skins and covered the city walls with them. These kings who had planned evil against the armies of Assyria, they brought before me to Nineveh. I had mercy upon Necho, one of their number, spared his life and laid an oath more drastic than the former upon him. I clothed him in splendid garments, laid upon his neck a golden chain as an emblem of his royalty. I put gold rings upon his fingers, gave him an iron girdle dagger set in gold, having written my name upon it. Chariots, horses, and mules I presented to him for his royal riding. My officials I sent with him at his request to serve as prefects. I set him back to his post at Sais, where his father had set him up as king, and his son. I set over Hathrabiah. I showed even greater favor than that of my father. So he forgave him and made him king. Put him in charge.
That's such an unusual show of mercy.
I know.
And this is where Necho sort of starts the 26th dynasty, right?
Pretty much. More like...
So now he's a proper pharaoh.
Yes.
Almost.
It's like his actually like his son is the one who will start the 26th dynasty.
But he must have been one hell of a sweet talker.
He must have been.
Like, Ashurbanipal, I'm sorry they convinced me to do bad things, but you know you need me to rule Egypt. You need a guy, a local guy on the scene. I can do this.
Exactly.
Yes, let me try again.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, you got to figure how far Egypt is from Nineveh. So, you know, he had to be quite a sweet talker. But we're going to talk more
also,
about him.
One more spoiler for Ashurbanipal. Because when I did the Ashurnasipal episodes back in the day, I thought that all the Assyrian kings would be like him and that there would be massacres all over. But there are really these depictions of massacres, etc. It's only Ashurnasipal II who do them like he did them. But Ashurbanipal will as well. So Ashurbanipal is an exceedingly cruel Assyrian king in his later days. But here he shows mercy. It's quite
and
amazing.
There's probably judgment, too, I would think. Like you said, he really needs somebody to run the place.
Yeah, and he does massacre some cities.
Yeah, he massacres the people. Yeah, that stinks. The king is the guy who does the deed, and then the city gets massacred.
So this Necho guy, I want to hear more about
him.
Yeah,
we're going to. But if we go in order, because something we're still not done, obviously. And, I mean, Taharqa just beat, he just beat the Assyrians at Thebes. So it's not over.
So it's a full-scale war in Egypt still.
I was thinking, too, like, you know, maybe a lot of times when they took someone to Nineveh and they never heard from again, maybe they just kept them there. You know how, like, the Babylonians captured the Hebrews and Judah and they just sort of kept them there?
I think somebody would have talked about that. The Assyrians would have bragged about having all these important prisoners.
Yeah, that's true.
On the other hand, maybe they should have bragged about
killing
them as well.
That's what I was thinking. So, yeah, you know, no. Maybe like to impress them, you know, like in the there's stories here in the U.S. In the late 1800s when we really became very industrialized, but we were still fighting with the Indians. They would take Indians to Washington, and then the Indians would come back and be like, we don't have a chance against these guys. We have no idea what their cities are like.
I'm also thinking of an incident in 260 CE when the... king of the Second Persian Empire takes the Roman emperor captive and then uses him as a footstool for the rest of the emperor's life.
No, was it Valens, right?
And then, of course, he told people about that. So, but the Assyrians just don't mention these people that are taken.
We'll just never know. That's the thing. I never heard from again except Necho.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Necho, the survivor.
Yeah, Necho, the survivor for now.
Okay, that's going to wrap it up for episode 2. Stay tuned for our next episode where we're coming into the year 666.
Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. Take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.